Hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Haunted History Chronicles. One of the most famous half-timbered houses in Britain, Speke Hall, seems to have more than its fair share of ghosts. Surrounded by a now grassy moat spanned by an Elizabethan stone bridge, Speke Hall actually started life in the late 15th century. It was expanded considerably in the 1530s by Sir William Norris to make room for his 19 children, and in 1795 was bought by Richard Watt, remaining in his family until it later was passed to the National Trust in 1943. The magnificent black and white half-timbered facades contain fascinating interiors spanning many centuries. The great hall and priest holes evoke Tudor times, while the oak parlour and smaller rooms, some with William Morris wallpapers, are evidence of the Victorian desire for privacy and comfort. There is also fine Jacobean plasterwork and intricately carved furniture. A fully equipped Victorian kitchen and servants' hall enable visitors to see behind the scenes. It is a house that endured through centuries of English unrest and turbulent history. It is also a house that bore witness to its own tragic stories, tales that have survived along with the hall, long after the people have not. For many, though, they believe that echoes of its past remain, with several spirits that are believed to still make their presence known. In the first half of the 20th century, the family and residents went through housekeepers in rapid succession, all of whom were in a hurry to leave, though they were reluctant to give any reason. All of them stayed in the ladies' maids' room, later known as the housekeeper's room, situated in what was the oldest part of the house, on the south end of the servants' corridor, on the east side. This room is now part of the staff accommodation, so it's not open to the public. The tapestry room or haunted room is above the main entrance on the north side, and was the bedroom occupied by Miss Watt, the last member of the family to live at Speke Hall. The walls were covered with tapestries, behind one of which was the door of a cupboard space, to the right-hand side of the fireplace. The door had a small catch, and the space gave access to the lower stack in the small dining room below, and as such provided an escape route out of the hall. The room can be visited as part of the winter season behind the scenes tours. The tapestry room is said to be haunted by the ghost of Lady Mary, though the facts are difficult to establish. Mary Norris inherited Speke Hall from her uncle in 1731, becoming an important and desirable heiress. 5 years later, she married the notorious Lord Sidney Beauclerk, the fifth son of the Duke of St. Albans, who was himself the illegitimate offspring of King Charles II and Nell Gwynne. Worthless Sidney, as he was called, loved high living and excess so much that eventually he was forced to return to Speke Hall and break the news to his wife that he had frittered away the family fortunes and that they faced ruin and disgrace. According to tradition, Lady Mary was so overcome with grief and anger that she picked up her infant son from his cradle and threw him from the window into the moat below. She then went to the Great Hall and committed suicide. The story is suitably dramatic, but it does not fit the facts. Lady Mary survived her husband by more than 20 years and died peacefully in 1766, while her only son survived until 1781. So the story may well be one that grew out of exaggeration and malice. Worthless Sidney may have had enemies whose descendants chose to make capital of his dissolute behaviour by blackening his reputation. Nevertheless, the tradition of a ghost at Speke Hall is long-standing. The references to a haunted chamber and the various appearances of a lady in white date back more than a century. One particular story concerns a ghost that is said to have appeared at a dining party by Miss Watts. It spoke to her guests and disappeared through a wall. Staff give credence to the idea that there is some sort of a ghost at Speke, reports of odd things happening from time to time. In the upper corridors, footsteps are often heard in an empty area, and voices heard in empty rooms. The eerie disembodied sounds of children crying heard breaking the silence, along with the unmistakable whisper of, Get out! From a dark, shadowy figure, often seen in the blue room. The sudden feeling of nauseousness is also a frequent report, something particularly noted by those entering the Great Hall. Our next examination is of Ham House. It's a location that also has a rather intriguing woman at the centre of its history. Set on a peaceful, lush bank of the River Thames, Ham House near Richmond is thought to be one of the National Trust's most prolifically haunted locations. Cold spots, sounds of footsteps, sightings of an imperious lady and a small dog, glimpses of a hurrying cleric and a profoundly gloomy young man, the inexplicable scent of roses and Virginia tobacco, and the mysterious nocturnal movement of furniture have given Ham House a busy reputation. A recent investigation at the house conducted overnight by the Ghost Club concluded that there could be as many as 15 phantoms in residence, including a number of dogs. Ham House was the life's work of the tenacious and strong-willed Duchess of Lauderdale, a highly ambitious aristocrat from 1626 to 1698. The Duchess would play a dangerous political game of intrigue with both Royalists and Puritans during the middle of the 17th century. By becoming a friend to both Cromwell openly and to Charles II secretly, she schemed and plotted to maintain her power base, and was even ruthless enough to sue her own family if they crossed her. It is her unquiet spirit, some believe, roams the house today. Elizabeth Murray inherited Ham House from her father in 1655. She was beautiful, but she was also described as restless in her ambition, profuse in her expense, and of a most ravenous covetousness. Her first marriage in 1648 was to Sir Lionel Tolmarsh, a wealthy squire, but even before his death in 1669, Lady Dysart, as she was then, was rumoured to have formed an attachment to John Maitland, 1st Earl of Lauderdale, Secretary of State for Scotland. 6 weeks after the death of his wife in 1672, John married Elizabeth, ignoring outraged public opinion about the unseemly haste of the match and dark rumours about the conveniently close deaths of both her husband and his wife, they set about extending and refurbishing Ham House in luxurious style that befitted the court of Charles II. But the Earl fell from royal favour and died in 1682. The Duchess found herself increasingly hard up. She even attempted to sue her husband's brother for the cost of her husband's lavish funeral expenses, an impressive bill of £5,000 back then. 10 years of unsuccessful litigations followed, and Elizabeth was forced to sell many of the treasures she had collected so avidly. She ended her days suffering from gout, barely able to move from room to room. She wrote, "I'm a prisoner now in my beloved Ham House, and I will never leave." She died in 1698, an embittered woman. The ground floor room to which she retreated, crippled jointly by infirmity and debt, is known as the Duchess's bedchamber. Highly ornate in decoration and strangely oppressive in atmosphere, the room emits sounds of footsteps and wafts of rose scent at all hours of the day and night. Rose was popular with the Stuart court, both as an effective perfume for the person and to camouflage less pleasant odours. An exquisite portrait by Sir Peter Lely of the Duchess as a young woman hangs over the mantelpiece. But it is the freestanding looking glass to one side which seems to provoke the most shudders. Visitors record a sensation of dread as they peer at the slightly clouded surface, as though they might see in the reflection a face not their own, or catch a glimpse of some malevolent looking figure standing directly behind them. Household pets are reluctant to enter, standing on the threshold quivering and hissing at the portrait. So powerful is the atmosphere in this room that some of the staff take the precaution of deferentially murmuring, "Good afternoon, Your Ladyship," before entering. During a recent Ghost Club investigation at Ham House, the group was joined by a direct descendant of the Duchess. Using dowsing rods, they were able to establish contact with the ghost, though she would only communicate with her relative. Having correctly identified him as a member of the family, the Duchess confirmed various facts about the intervening 10 generations. She volunteered the information that he had a brother, that his father's life had been unhappy, and that the men of the family traditionally went into the guards. The entity also claimed that there was a picture of her in the room, and, when asked to do so, directed the dowsing rods to the Lely portrait of the Duchess as a young woman hanging over the fireplace. The atmosphere in the nearby dining room is quite different, but it too is the source of some inexplicable sensations. Elizabeth's second husband was very fond of both convivial company at the dining table and distinctively aromatic Virginia tobacco. What is perhaps surprising is that certain visitors seem to immediately pick up not just a scent of tobacco, but a real draught of it. The mayor of Richmond remarked on it, even though the mayoress standing next to him could smell nothing. On another occasion, a group of local firemen protested that smoking should not be allowed in a house of that age. More alarming than scents and perfumes is the accompanying sounds of footsteps on the stairs, usually at night, and which appear to not affect the electronic alarms usually activated by any movement or vibration. Interestingly, if the footsteps are heard going in one direction, they can be heard later returning along the same route. Recently, sets of naked footprints have appeared overnight, both on the stairs and in the Duchess's bedchamber. Staff are unable to explain this strange phenomenon, especially as both sets of prints appear to have lifted the varnish from the ancient floorboards, as if the imprint was burnt on it in some way. The guides have also noticed that they have to be careful where they stand on the stairs while giving an introductory talk to visitors. More than one astonished speaker has had the sensation of a blow or a shove between the shoulder blades if they have the temerity to stand on the third step. It may be significant that this spot was also the focus of a strange photograph taken in November 2003 by a group of psychic investigators. A strange light anomaly appears in the image, although not visible at the time. On analysis, neither the photographic equipment nor the film used was found to be faulty that day. On numerous occasions, a woman in a long black dress has been seen slowly descending the staircase and turning into the chapel at the bottom. On the death of her second husband, the Duchess spent a week in the chapel kneeling and praying over his coffin. It was the finding of a handprint on the rail of the Duchess's pew, clearly visible in the light film of dust the morning after workmen had sealed and set the alarms in the chapel for the night, which disconcerted the staff and volunteers. The lady in black is sometimes seen entering the chapel, followed by a chaplain, believed to be the faithful Gilbert Spinks, her husband's secretary and devoted servant. But perhaps the most frequent ghostly visitor is that of a small spaniel-like dog, glimpses of which have been recorded on many occasions over the last 2 centuries, trotting purposefully along corridors in the house. Typically it appears running ahead of visitors, up the great stairs into the museum room, and up to a showcase which covers a former doorway, at which point it promptly vanishes. Indignant visitors have protested that they were forced to leave their pets outside, while someone else had been given permission to bring in their King Charles Spaniel. But when they see the famous painting in the gallery, they readily identify the dog they saw a few moments before. In fact, during recent construction work, workmen recovered a large sundial from the centre of the kitchen garden, and underneath discovered the grave of a small dog. The bones are currently on temporary show in the house, below the double portrait of the Duke and Duchess, at the height of their power. A tale relating to the ghostly Duchess was recorded in 1879. A 6-year-old girl was staying overnight at Ham House, thought to be the daughter of the butler, and she awoke in the middle of the night to see an old woman scrabbling at a patch of wall near to the fireplace. The little girl screamed, and the apparition disappeared, and subsequent investigations are believed to have turned up a secret compartment hidden in the wall where she was scrabbling, and containing old documents which proved the Duchess had murdered her first husband in order to marry her second. No trace of this proof has reached the public domain, but Elizabeth's contemporaries clearly thought she was capable of anything. but there are other apparitions from different eras which also occur at Ham House. On frosty winter mornings and late at night, a young man has been seen walking along the terrace, hands clasped, apparently deep in thought. He's believed to be John McFarlane, who came to stay in the house and promptly fell in love with a lady's maid, an unwise choice in the eyes of his highborn family. His love was unrequited. Throughout the winter of 1779, he plied her with gifts and asked her to marry him, but she refused. The story is that she was already in love with the head steward. In desperation, he etched his name and the date, 1780, into the glass of an upstairs window, the fourth from the right on the terrace facade. Unable to bear his rejection any longer, one night he jumped to his death on the terrace, two floors below. Staff and guests at Ham House have since been horrified to hear a blood-curdling scream outside the top floor window on the anniversary of his suicide, and the sound of sobs from the garden area known as the Wilderness. The scream is believed to be that of the repentant maid, who nevertheless did marry the head steward. A poignant story is attached to the sighting of a 20th century ghost in what was then an informal gated East Garden, but is now the Cherry Garden. The 9th Earl of Dysart had no children of his own, but he was a good uncle to various nephews and nieces, including Leon Sextus Tolmarsh, who as a child was especially fond of playing in the East Garden. It was at Ham House that Leon's uncle threw a special dinner party for the young man, so that he could propose marriage to his girlfriend, who accepted. So the house, and particularly that part of the garden, always had happy associations for Leon. During the First World War, Leon and many younger male members of Ham House staff were away fighting in France. On the morning of the 20th of February 1917, the old gardener was startled to see Leon wearing full army uniform in the garden. He hurried to the main house, expecting to be the first with the surprising news that the young master had been sent home on leave from the front. When he arrived at the main house, the gardener was told he must have been mistaken. A few days later, the telegram arrived. Leon had been killed in action on the very morning he was seen in his favourite garden. Another ghostly encounter is one set around Christmas Eve. The 9th Earl was confined to a wheelchair later in his life following a hunting accident, but every Christmas Eve he made a point of leaving the building by the west door. Bearing his weight on a stick, he would slowly walk across the courtyard to the cottage where his chauffeur, Mr. Allen, lived with his family, to give them a basket of presents. On the first Christmas Eve after the Earl died in 1935, Mr. Allen heard the unmistakable sounds of the west door closing, and through a window saw the familiar figure advancing slowly with a stick and basket. There was a double thump on the door of the cottage, but when the bewildered chauffeur opened it, the courtyard was deserted. The 9th Earl's wheelchair is still to be seen in the house. Staff are mystified to explain how, whenever the chair is moved from its regular spot for cleaning and other domestic routines, it always seems to return to its original place by morning, despite the sensitive alarms which should detect any movement. One happier vision occasionally seen at Ham House is the figure of an attractive woman glimpsed at a particular window on the first floor. She wears an ornate 18th century dress and waves with one hand, keeping the other firmly behind her back. The spirit is believed to be that of Charlotte Walpole, the natural daughter of Edward Walpole and niece of Sir Horace Walpole, the Gothic novelist, Member of Parliament and bon viveur. Charlotte was illegitimate, and this gave her dubious social status, but she was wealthy, and the 5th Earl Dysart, who had social clout but little money, was fond of her, and married her within a week of their first meeting. There was an advantage to both sides with such a match. As Charlotte put it, "If I was 19, I would refuse point blank. I do not like to be married in a week to a man I never saw. But I am 22. Some people say I am handsome, some say I am not. I believe the truth is that I am likely to be large and go off soon. It is dangerous to refuse so great a match." An appealing portrait of Charlotte can be seen in the Great Hall, One hand is concealed in the painting. It's believed that she had a withered or deformed hand. When Charlotte appears nowadays, it is usually seen as a presentiment of something good happening to the present-day residents and staff at the house, such as recovery from illness, or the safe delivery of a baby. Perhaps therefore it is fitting that Charlotte's illustrious uncle was one of the many visitors over the centuries to surmise that Ham House has many ghostly inhabitants. He wrote, "Every minute I expected to see ghosts sweeping by, ghosts I would not give sixpence to see, Lauderdales, Tolmarshes, and Maitlands." Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed hearing the stories of these two incredible properties and the matriarchs who once resided in them. See you next time.
If you like this podcast, there's a number of things you can do. Come and join us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Spread the word about us with friends and family. Leave a review on our website or other podcast platforms. To support the podcast further, why not head on over to join us on Patreon, where you can sign up to gain a library of additional material and recordings, and in the process know you're helping the podcast continue to put out more content. On a final note, if you haven't read it already, then you can find my piece In Search of the Medieval in Volume 3 of The Feminine Macabre over on spookeats.com or via Amazon. Links to the book will also be in the episode description. Thank you everyone for your amazing support.